When Walter first asked me to speak on hiddenness in the Sermon on the Mount with reference to the book, The Narrow Path by Rich Villodas, we say in Arkansas, we'd say it Villodas, but you know, it's fine. I thought, Walter, you gotta be kidding. I mean, as a program director for an organization that trains medics in Burma, we survive on being unhidden. We actively try to unhide ourselves. We want to not only tell you about what we're doing, we want to pull you into the jungle so you hear it and feel it too. So, you know, then I realized through some more correspondence, Walter, that actually he felt like we had something to say because of these activities, that maybe we can look at some of Jesus' words a little bit more closely. But just to warn you, Walter, as I tell some of our team members, sometimes they're just superheroes, unbelievable on our team. And then half the time, Mr. Bean shows up, so we're not sure who's going to be here today. But on the surface level, it does seem like Jesus is contradicting himself. The first passage we read, he says, Jesus, you are the light of the world. A town built on a hill cannot be hidden. Neither do people light a lamp and put it under a bowl. Instead, they put it on its stand, and it gives light to everyone in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others, that they may see your good deeds and glorify the Father in heaven. But then just a few lines later, he talks about, be careful not to practice your righteousness in front of others to be seen by them. And then in the sermon, he goes on to apply that to three disciplines, discipline of fasting, of praying, and giving. So what is it? Do we shine or do we hide? Well, I think Jesus also gives us the answer. It's not so much what we do that makes a difference. It's why we're doing it. Jesus says, let your good deeds shine so that your Father in heaven is glorified. Don't do your good deeds to be seen by others. So that condition of the heart is what makes the difference. He insists that, you know, even if we're doing good deeds, if our heart is self-orientated, we're going to lose the kingdom value of that. So early in the book, Rich Villodas warns us, we may be on the broad road if we believe God only cares about our behavior, not our heart. Jesus is never about adjusting behavior alone. He cares about who we are, becoming, not just what we do. He rejects a spirituality that doesn't transform our hearts. St. Paul says it even more dramatically in Galatians, I have been crucified with Christ, and I no longer live, but Christ lives in me. The life I now live in the body, I live by faith in the Son of God who loved me and gave himself for me. So it's not just about doing the good deeds. It's about dying to self and living a new life from a transformed heart. Jesus himself later describes this narrow way of discipleship and about the battle for the inner life. Whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up the cross and follow me. Jesus had a word for those that focused on the external without that inner transformation. And he called them hypocrites. Actually, we use the word hypocrite today a little bit differently than they did first century Palestine. Today we mean a hypocrite is somebody that does one thing and then, or says one thing and does the other thing. But Jesus's word, at least the word in Matthew, the Greek word, just means an actor, like a stage actor, somebody on the stage. He's performing. He's doing it just to be seen, for the appearance of it. So Jesus is saying, don't do that. Apparently, first century Palestine, they had these big theaters. Actually, there was one close to where Jesus grew up, that seated 4,000 people. And it's in a city that was maybe a few miles. It was actually a boom town that probably required a lot of carpentry work, so perhaps Jesus, when he was a young person, spent time there. But without the modern assist of some of the technology of good lights, cameras, microphones, there were probably a lot of people in this 4,000-seat arena that couldn't see the stage very well. They couldn't see the actors, who was coming on stage. Actors then being like actors now, want to be recognized. So apparently the more famous ones would announce their entrance onto the stage with a trumpet blast. They would actually, so that's what Jesus is saying, don't be like that. Don't, when you give, don't be like the actor that's announcing his presence or his entrance on stage with a trumpet. In my mind, I'm imagining people hearing that with a little bit of a grin, you know, some self-inflated actor that wants the trumpet sound when he goes on. And he's saying, when you give, don't be like that Mr. Bean guy. And I can see them chuckling to themselves. But when you pray, don't go full Broadway on stage. When you fast, don't put the hungry makeup on. It's like, don't do that. Acting is only for show. It isn't for real. On the other end of the spectrum, Jesus' teachings in the Sermon on the Mount is about how a life is lived out from a transformed heart. And I think that's what he's getting at. It's this transformation of the heart. But that's the problem, right? At 66 years old, you know, I figured out by now that actually my heart is strongly orientated to my own needs and my own desires. Even if I want to do what God wants for me, I find myself being drawn by discomfort or security. They play large in my decisions for what I do. And by now, I've also learned whatever sits on the throne of your heart, very over time, ends up controlling and ruling your whole life. And if God isn't the one sitting there, you're in big trouble. So how do we change? How do we transform that heart? I think Viotas focuses on a couple of spiritual disciplines. Richard Foster, in his book, Celebration of Discipline, describes the spiritual disciplines like this. God has given us the disciplines of a spiritual life as a means of receiving his grace. The disciplines allow us to place ourselves before God so that he can transform us. I just want to repeat that. The disciplines allow us to place ourselves before God so that he can transform us. So all of these disciplines seem to have two parts to it. One part involves us actively doing something or not doing something, like in fasting. The other part is God doing something and transforming our hearts. So I don't see any of the disciplines that just happen automatically, like a fire and forget missile. There's the we do something, and then we mean to make ready to receive the work God is doing in us. So Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount highlights three different principles: fasting, praying, and giving. All of these have that doing and receiving part. Viotas focuses on two of these. He focuses on the prayer and the fasting part, and he has a lot of really good things to say about that, and I would strongly recommend you reading that and seeing how that applies to our modern day life. But he didn't say much on the discipline of giving, so I thought I'd like to fill that out a little bit, giving as a discipline. So when we're talking about that giving as a discipline, I think it's useful to break that down into two different kinds of giving. One kind of giving is indirect. So this is when you give money to missions like us on the other side of the world, but you don't really have contact, direct contact with those that you're helping. The other is more of a direct giving, where you're actually giving your time, your resources, your energy directly to that person. So as a program director of an organization that depends on donations, I think it's really important for us to be able to communicate well back to the donors. Because in order for that to work, giving to work as a discipline, if you do something, you need to be in a receiving position. And I think that is why getting good communications back from the field is so important for it to really work as a discipline. So that's why, Walter, I'm really trying to unhide our story. Because, again, in order for that to work as a discipline, you need to get feedback to know what God's doing in our part of the world. So I want to try to pull you into that world. I'm going to tell stories. I want you to hear the bugs and the bird songs. I want you to see all the different varieties of green in the jungle, to smell the rain after it, the freshness in the rain. I want you to also know the weight of what it's like when a little five-year-old girl comes in that's been hit in an airstrike and her intestines are coming out, the weight of treating that. I want you to hear our prayers for that little girl as we operate on her during the night. I want you to feel the joy that we have when we see her starting to recover, and how our hearts are pulled toward that little girl just as we treat her over time. And to hear our prayers for her every day on doing rounds. So I want you to be there with us, because I know at least in part you're giving the money in order for it to be a discipline. To have that second part depends on knowing what's going on, how God is moving, and what he's generally doing with your funds. So we get to see that up close and personal every day. But we need to share that with you so that you too may see the good works that God is doing and praise the Father, not just from in word, but from a transformed heart. So for those you guys have given us money, we thank you, and really sincerely thank you. And we pray that God would move in a strong way as we communicate back to what he's doing. The parable of the sheep and the goats that was read up here is about the other kind of giving. This is about the direct giving. Note the verbiage that is used. Your clothing, your visiting, your doing something. Okay, this is directly interacting with those in need. How do you read that parable? It's a little bit scary, right? Seems to say on the surface, if you're helping those in need, you're going to go to heaven. If you aren't, you're going to be condemned to hell. Is that the way Jesus is meaning it? Are we earning merit by doing these things? If I feed somebody that's hungry, I'm going to go to heaven? Again, I would say that Vyodas says, no, that's a focus on external. He called that in his book moralism. Jesus himself has called that acting. That's what a hypocrite does. He focuses on this external without any attention to the internal. So as a discipline, giving directly puts us in a place where we're interacting with somebody that Jesus himself identifies with. Jesus says, whatever you do to the least of these, you do to me. So I think what he's saying is not your good deeds will earn you heaven, but come spend time with me. Come put your hands on me. And then that interaction, I will transform your heart. I will fill you with fruits of the Spirit. Your salvation does not depend on doing good deeds. Your salvation depends on getting to know me. And this is one way you can get to know me, by directly helping those in need. More specifically, in my experience, that inner work comes directly from direct giving is related to the fruits of the Spirit. Sometimes when we help these, like this little five-year-old girl, your heart is drawn to her, and you find yourself loving like my granddaughters. Sometimes it's joy or inexplicable peace. Sometimes it's patience. Sometimes it's self-control when you are helping those in need. But I think if you look at it as saying we should see this as coming from Jesus's, we're ministering to him, and he's going to transform our inner hearts. One time I was in the jungle, and I was talking with some friends, my friend Rekha, and I was asking him, what does human dignity mean to you? And I was kind of expecting this answer that, oh, dignity is my right as a human. He said, dignity, he's a Karen, one of my Karen friends, he said, dignity is our ability to give. A father gives something to a son. A village gives a meal to a stranger. That's our dignity. And he's a medic so at that time. And so I asked him, so if you saw one of the enemy, one of the Burma Army soldiers in need, would you give to him? He paused a second. He said, if he's asking for my help, I would do everything I can for him. What he does with that later is up to him. So fast forward two or three years, he and I were deep in the jungle. We had walked all night. I just washed out my clothes in the river and was washing up, put up the hammock, was resting a little bit, had some lunch. Later in that evening, Reiko Town came down to get me, and he said, there's a Burmese porter who's stepped on the landmine and come to the clinic, and we think we need to do an amputation. We want you to do the nerve block for pain. We didn't have any general anesthetic at the time, so we can give a femoral nerve and a sciatic nerve block to block most of the pain. So I went up there, and I looked at the guy, and they had controlled the bleeding. It wasn't infected. It didn't look that bad. He still had good pulses. The limb was warm. I said, I think, teacher, I think we can, if we get him to orthopedic specialist, that we'll be able to save his leg. So we went down to, I was on a sat phone. By this time, it's dark. So we're looking for a clearing in the jungle so we can get a satellite signal out. And I called the orthopedic guys in Thailand. They said, yeah, we'll accept them. So I'm going up, back up, walking up to the hospital to tell them that. And Reiko's next to me, and he comes a little bit close, and he kind of whispers. He says, actually, Thra means teacher. Actually, teacher, we don't think he's a Burmese porter. We're pretty sure he's a Burma Army guy that stepped on a landmine and got left behind. And we, from the way he's talking, we think he's an officer. Okay, this is the real enemy. This is not just somebody that's insulted you. This guy is an officer responsible for the burning and killing and raping of his people. This is a real enemy. And so I ask him, Thra, what do you want to do with him? We're in the middle of nowhere. I'm pretty sure I know what they would do with him in Arkansas. He said, I think we should do everything we can for him. What he does with that afterwards is up to him. Maybe, and he added, maybe this is God's last chance for him. So I went up to there, and I'm talking to him, and I say, okay, we're going to get you to Thailand, get you to orthopedic care, so we don't think he starts crying. And I'm noticing he's kind of portly. So I've never met a fat porter. I think their assessment was correct. I didn't have the presence of mind to tell him, but I wish I would. I said, man, you need to think about what you're doing. These guys know who you are. They know you're an officer in the Burma Army and doing these things, and they're still willing to carry you out. And they did. They carried him out to get him care. This is the enemy. And it took him about a week, and the carrying him is no joke in the jungle. They'll use a long bamboo pole, and they put a hammock on that, and they physically have, then two guys will carry him, they carried him to surgical care. And I've seen the Karen do this again and again, this kind of thing. I mean, this is the Sermon on the Mount being lived out in front of me. I'm supposed to be a missionary there, and I'm seeing Jesus here in my guise. I know Reiko himself has had and more enemy soldiers that are wounded, and he takes care of them, even when others are saying, don't waste your medicine on them, don't waste your food on them. One of the good friends of mine, the general surgeons, he and I are very close. We were on the front line, and there was two guys that were injured. One was the enemy soldier, and one was the Karen guy. And they both had similar abdominal injuries. And I said, Thra, which one is which? Who's the enemy soldier and who's the other one? He said, I don't know, and I'm not asking. So they're not all of us are strong as Reiko, but he knew enough of what he should do. So that's, I think, is a real example of real life, the Sermon on the Mount in real life, and what giving means to these guys.